Hello and welcome to another special episode of the Offside Musings podcast. My name is Oke Ndibe. It's my delight to welcome you on behalf of my co-host Emeka Onyagwa. In today's episode, we're going to look at a really devastating development in the southeastern part of Nigeria, at least parts of the southeastern part of Nigeria. And this has to do with the two-week sit-at-home order that a faction of the indigenous peoples of Biafra, led by Simon Ekpa, declared recently. On account of this sit-at-home order, so many people were either beaten up, a few were killed, goods were smashed. Basically, a lot of fear was struck in the hearts of people in parts of the Southeast. And so today we're going to look at all of that and to see whether these strategies are counterproductive to the stated aims of Simon Ekpa's IPOB. So it's my delight to welcome you to this episode.
All right. Simon Ekpa, your best friend.
I wish. Oh, no, I hope not.
You hope not? I heard, I don't know him that well, but I did hear that he had some episodes. I don't know, I can't remember exactly what the episodes were in the East, Nigeria. I believe members of his family got killed, assassinated, something in that direction, in a very painful manner by herdsman, something in that direction. I know he had an episode of some sort, and it radicalized him. You know, the guy is a parliamentarian in Finland. He lives in Finland, has a Finnish wife, served the Finnish military, is a parliamentarian there. That's one thing I've never really sat down to look at there, but he is an elected official in Finland.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, elected or not, this is my first take on this whole sit-at-home order. As you know, I have never been in favor of ordering people to sit at home, whether it's one day or 2 days or a week or 2 weeks. Now, this has nothing to do with the situation of Nnamdi Kanu. I have always argued that the Nigerian state is not beyond question. The Nigerian state is not sacred. In other words, I believe fully in the possibility of dismembering Nigeria. Okay? I don't believe at all in the Nigerian state. I think that the state has potential, but so far it's promised and delivered mostly hell, not just to people in the southeast of the country, but indeed to all Nigerians. So I don't think that Nigeria works for any section of Nigeria apart from a very tiny elite, you know, who make a killing, as it were, out of that country. So Nnamdi Kanu has been detained for a long time. His crime was calling for the dismemberment of Nigeria, calling for the actualization of this of the Republic of Biafra, if you like. I have my misgivings about that call. I lived through the Biafran War, Civil War, which is alternately called the Biafran Civil War. I was a child during that war. I saw the horrors of that war, and I saw both the horrors inflicted on the southeast, on the Biafran heartland, by Nigerian authorities, as well as the callousness of Biafran officials during that war. So it's important that people who think that once we have Biafra, all our problems will disappear. It's important that they understand that there was profound injustice within Biafra, and we can get into that in a minute. But Nnamdi Kanu has the right. Has the right. In fact, because he feels passionately about it, he has a duty to demand the dismemberment of Nigeria, to demand the extraction of the southeastern flank of Nigeria out of that country. There should be nothing incriminating, it shouldn't be a criminal act that you make such a demand, okay? Because the Nigerian state itself is constituted as a criminal entity and acts in an egregiously criminal manner. So anybody who criticizes this criminal enterprise of a nation should not, by definition, be jailed. The last I checked, Nnamdi Kanu, despite the fierceness of his rhetoric, did not engage in acts of violence. Okay? So his continued detention, despite a court order declaring improper the means by which he was captured in Kenya and brought to Nigeria, that act represents part of the ongoing criminality of the Nigerian state. So with every well-meaning Nigerian, every IPOB activist who demands that Nnamdi Kanu be released, I want him released not tomorrow, I want him released yesterday. He should not be held in detention. But then, when the IPOB or factions of it declare a state of emergency, I wonder as to the intelligence behind that declaration. First of all, what are you doing? What are they doing? What they are doing is that they are deepening misery, suffering in what they call Biafra land in the southeast. They are creating economic pauperization. Poor people who do very basic trading just to be able to put food on the table perhaps once a day often lose everything. You know, I once spoke with a woman on a visit to Nigeria. The woman told me that she sells tomatoes. So she sells tomatoes from Monday, she sells tomatoes from Tuesday to Saturday. She doesn't go on Sunday because she's a Christian. Then on Monday, IPOB will say to her, you can't come out. And she says that by the following Tuesday, that a lot of our tomato is gone rotten. Okay. So this woman told me that if everything works out for her well, that she just makes enough to give her children, and she's a widow, by the way, to give her children food occasionally. So it is callous on the part of IPOB, on the part of Simon Ekpa, who lives comfortably in Finland, to insist that this woman continue to suffer. And that sort of is the kind of argument that some sympathizers of IPOB have made. They say, oh, there's no revolution or struggle without sacrifice. What are they sacrificing? Okay. Will they then, those of them, especially those of them who are abroad, commit that they will donate their salaries for one day in the week and put it in a fund to help poor people, the poor people that they disenfranchise in the Southeast by their stay-at-home order? So that's one. The other thing is the incalculable. So, you know, so we talk about the economic cost of the sit-at-home order. Nobody, of course, has put a figure to it, but I can tell you that it is a very high order of magnitude. Then there is the incalculable social misery. Okay? I can tell you, again, that I personally know of a woman who died because she was ill and she couldn't be taken to the hospital on a Monday. And she died at home. So there are women who are pregnant, who are about to give birth on Monday, and suddenly nobody, they can't find transportation to take them to the hospital. And when they get to the hospital, hospital staff often do not work, okay? You do know of the case last year, the year before, when children who were sitting their WAEC exams could not sit for their English and math exams because those fell on a Monday. So IPOB, in a sense, is, at least to the extent that they insist that sit-at-home order is a wise move. They are contributing to the absolute devastation of our children's future, of the economic survival of the least, the most disadvantaged of Igbo people. And so I think that there's an emergency in the Southeast. And that emergency in a country where the government is attuned to civil liberties and civil rights will take it seriously and stop this unconscionable attacks on the poor. So that's my opening thought.
With Simon Epa, Ralph Wazuriki was living in Nigeria at that point in time. I felt it was a different. I'm not sure he's still alive. I don't think so. But
Ralph Wazuriki.
He is? Oh, okay. So, yeah. And that's bad. I thought he wasn't active in that space. Mm-hmm. But clearly, he's not active in that space anymore. Mm-hmm. Nnamdi Kanu comes in as well. Nnamdi Kanu comes in at the beginning of, not even the beginning, when cattle herders and listen, when it gets a lot worse in Nigeria, he comes in and starts talking and all that. So essentially, for me, I don't. Even though all these people are different in terms of Nnamdi the Kanu, Ralph, and this thing, and Simon Epa, I think for one, just logically, there's no reason to hold them. Nnamdi Kanu, his charges are just charges to keep him in prison and all those kind of things. So, so there's no need to hold him. Same way I feel about people like. Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. But those guys are different. They are whistleblowers. They are different set up entirely. So with that, in terms of what's happening in the Southeast and all that. So it's interesting. It's interesting. It is a symptom of the problem. To a large degree. So it doesn't matter whether it's people fighting in the Southeast or wherever it is, it's the same problem. You don't have structures, you don't have a country, you don't have the economic system that works. Mm-hmm. So overall, it doesn't make any sense to sit down. Actually, in this case, this has been done by angry people who are disenfranchised. Doesn't make any sense to destroy more people and make them more disenfranchised overall. So, that's essentially where I'm at with it. It doesn't overall make any sense for people to do that. It's just a manifestation of the problem, essentially.
Okay, so by the way, I don't think Simon Epa is a Finnish parliamentarian. From all indications, he's called in some circles the Prime Minister of the Biafran Republic, right? But I don't think that I don't think that he's a parliamentarian in Finland at all. I think he was in the military in Finland. But so to sort of, again, explore some of the consequences of the sit-at-home order, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quite apart from the people who have died as a result of the sit-at-home order itself, like the pregnant woman, pregnant women who are unable to go to maternity to have their children, the sick woman that I know of who died because she couldn't be transported to the hospital. There's also the fact that a lot of people, some parts of the Southeast, have become absolutely deserted by some of the most well-to-do elements in those communities. I do know that in Ihiala, for example, and its surrounding communities, that a lot of this, a lot of the indigenous of those areas are unable, have been unable to go home for close to 3 years. I again know of a case of a man who lost his mom in Lagos, and a few months later lost his wife. And this man had to do the wake for his mother and his wife in Lagos. And he had to send some operators in the dead of night to sneak into Ihiala, his community, to dig graves and to bury his mom and his wife. He could not get to his community himself. So the act of burial, and in Igbo culture, the burial of the deceased is an important rite of passage. It brings the entire community together. There is a reflection on the life of the departed. There are prayers. And it's a very social occasion, right? The dead is accompanied to, as it were, to immortality with dances, with sometimes with masquerades, by the community coming together to celebrate the life of the departed, right? And part of what comes with this is that, you know, the groups that come to dance, a lot of them are paid. The people who cook are paid. The people who supply the drinks, the security, the people who sweep, and so on and so forth. And the community gets to come together in a kind of, yes, there's mournfulness, but there's also celebration, okay? So all of that social and economic activity is abrogated on account of the sit-at-home order and on account of the infiltration of some IPOB actors who have become indistinguishable from criminals. So what has happened, obviously, is that there are people who have in IPOB who are in it because they believe in achieving a Biafran national entity. But because of the climate of criminality, you now see rogue elements who pretend that they are acting in pursuit of Biafra, but really what they're doing is that they're engaging in kidnapping, they engage in robbery, they engage in assault, they engage in rape, and so on and so forth. And, you know, some cells of IPOB so-called leaders were, exposed, I believe, late last year or early this year. And a lot of young women, you know, who were have been abducted to serve the sexual needs of the so-called agitators of Biafra. It's sickening. Okay, it is sickening. So what kind of country do you want to, what kind of Biafra do you want to achieve when you make it impossible for young kids in the Southeast to sit their entrance exams without which they cannot gain admission to universities? And some people just say, oh yeah, you know, it's all sacrifice, but they would not let their own children, because some of those who say that nonsense are Southeasterners who live either in the US or UK or somewhere outside of Nigeria. And I said to them, it's easy to say, why not send your own children into Nigeria and then let them lose the opportunity to go to school? Why not you either donate your salary, or you sit at home, whether you are in America or you are in the UK or you are in Finland, sit at home on Monday. Don't go to work. Okay, so either lose the income for that day or take your earning and support the poor in Igbo land, in the Southeast. It doesn't really make sense. So the other element of it is, on the one hand, you say that Buhari hated people from the southeastern part of the country. And in some of his policies, Buhari did exhibit, execrable nepotism, to put it mildly. So I'm not going to deny that Buhari is not a hater of people from southern parts of Nigeria. But then, if Buhari hates you, do you think that if you then start destroying your homeland, that Buhari was going to be so moved and say, oh, let me stop these people from destroying their homeland, so let me give them what they want? No. If your analysis is correct, and I think that there's some legitimacy to that analysis, then Buhari would actually be happy that you're doing his work for him by destroying your lives and the lives of your people. Now, the argument is again that Tinubu, who may or may not continue as president, depending on how the tribunals rule, if the argument is that Tinubu again detests the Igbo, why do you think that if you are shooting Igbo people, smashing the businesses, the goods that poor Igbo businessmen and women have displayed, that when you do that, that Tinubu is going to be so moved to now say, oh, let me stop their suffering, so let me give them Biafra. At any rate, another way in which they sit at home, or that for me is counterproductive, is for a lot of Igbo people, for a lot of them, their experience of Biafra takes two forms. Those of us who were born during the Biafran War recognize the unspeakable horror and suffering, the hunger, the kwashiorkor, the illness, the senseless death, the destruction that war wrought, okay? But then there are those who were not born then. And some of them then will see Biafra through the activities of the Simon Ekpas and some of the criminals, really, who presume to represent Biafra. So if Biafra means the killing of your own people, the destruction of their businesses, the infliction of death and of suffering on them by blocking their access to hospitals and to schooling and to economic activity, if that's what they see that Biafra represents, I can tell you that even if the Nigerian government were to offer the opportunity for a referendum on the Biafran question, it's likely to fail. Because I don't see any self-interested person, anybody who believes even in enlightened self-interest, I don't see how they would choose that some of those miscreants who are shooting people openly, okay, who are wrecking the futures of our young men and women, okay, who are raping the young, okay, who are destroying the businesses of elderly and widowed women. I don't see why they would think that this is a future that is so attractive that they embrace it and vote for it in a referendum. So everything you are doing smacks really of ignorance, the kind of ignorance that you accuse the people who ostensibly are oppressing your people. It doesn't make sense on any level.
Yeah. I don't know, like I said, it ends up being a symptom, a manifestation of the problem. So that'll be another if it's time on it, but Simon Ekpa is not available tomorrow. But I was checking out to see, he's a Finnish politician. He is a member of the current Prime Minister's party. He did stand for elections in 2022. I'm trying to find the results of the election because I believe even on his website, he had that listed as serving in some capacity. So I went to his website, but his website is down at this time. You'd have to ask him why. I don't know. But that's the website he uses. It's down. But even if Simon Ekpa were to sail off into the sunset or Nnamdi Kanu sails off into the sunset, the reality is there's a problem in Nigeria and it's manifesting itself. It's a growing country. It's a very young country. It's a country that produces very intelligent people, but also people that think in a certain way that is counterproductive to progress. Generally, it's not everybody, but generally. So you have a country that's taking 20 steps backwards. I mean, what do I mean by these things, right? Now people make TikTok videos. They're asking somebody, or TikTok, YouTube, whichever, Instagram videos. They're asking people like, yeah, what's the good thing that Tinubu has done? They went to ask, is serious Yoruba speaker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started asking a bunch of questions. What is up here? What is appointing Yoruba people? And that's all that matters, right? So, and that consciously or unconsciously, even though this person is, you know, on lower economic levels of society in Nigeria, that says a lot. Even though it's down on high economic levels, they think that way, but they don't articulate it that way. But they do think that way, that this is, or not all they do, for the majority think that way. So you have a situation where you have a country that is expanding the young population, and people just assuming that things are given. It's like Tinubu went to Paris and told the world can't ignore Nigeria. I don't know what he means, or you know, what he was doing, whatever he was indulging in that day. I've got no idea. That's the thing that he's a rational being, because some people are not rational enough. I was watching another thing today, and some Odyssey supporters that. I was watching a live stream that came to live out in America, and they made all kinds of statements that made me believe that one, they do live here, but two, they also live in poverty here. I'm not trying to knock them, but because everything they were speaking was highly inaccurate, and they seem to be auditioning for jobs in Nigeria more than any other thing. Not calling it a live stream or this thing, but the main point is this guy was throwing out all the same things. Oh, Nigeria, you know, that the only reason why people, in essence, his summary of which it was a Tinubu friendly distance, is that the only reason why people are going to these populations in India, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, is because the media is
talking about them as the next issue. They need to talk about Nigeria that way. That's all they need to be. Nigeria just needs to be talked about that way. I know it's okay for you. I know I was using it for comedy, so wrap up my brain, but it was very funny to listen to that, which is always, it's the very typical thing to listen to. It's really Nigeria, sometimes talking about Nigeria, talking to Nigerians here a lot of times. It's very bipolar, very intelligent people, but people like intelligent, great textiles, Nigerian, the Kailas, all that great stuff. But people that are still hungry to think in a certain way. Doesn't matter, they think in a certain way. And you had this guy talking about the only problem with this thing is that the media, there's no media coverage about the young population. That's not how economics works. It's the same thing with Simon Ekpa and whoever might come next. That this is not sitting at home. If for anything, what you should be talking about is the inverse of that. What you should be talking about is how you should have some kind of positive discrimination where you buy Igbo so that you can fund your activities. What you're now talking about is how you're taking out money from people's pockets.
Yeah.
I know 20% of Nigeria's foreign expenditure is foreign direct investment. And what that essentially means is almost 99% is remittances.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people there subsist with remittances. There are a lot of people who just go about doing their businesses, and you are reversing and taking away a large percentage of you know, that's a lot of it, but economic activities going to see people. This is a summer period. A lot of people would want to go for vacation in Nigeria are not going to do that. You're taking that away from people. So, you know, it's the Nigerian side. You can say, you know, it's the Igbo people, or is this, or Lagos is great. Lagos, I saw on Netflix, it was so funny. The guy was trying to compare healthcare in Nigeria and healthcare. It just shows me how much the elites are typically very delusional. I have a friend who I remember, he's good friends with my wife, and I remember, and she has a big name. I'm going to say where she's from, but big enough that they have highways named after them, and they've had documentaries, and her father's house has been on documentaries of the rich and all that. And they all went to the same school. She did her distant, did her MBA in the same school. They all went to the same school, my wife and all that, and my wife Jean and all that. And then she was the last person that wanted to live in America. I remember when I was walking in the city, she was, when she did her MBA, she did an internship, but not that kind of, you know, she had some kind of like, I wish I had gotten like a job like this to go into the city, but yeah, I'd rather go and live in Nigeria. It was a long time ago, going to 2 decades ago. Yeah, somewhere, like 15 years maybe, somewhere around that. Somewhere I would never like, you know, lives in quite a few quotes in Nigeria that you can find pretty much. Right now, even she's sat down and she's like, nah, she's moving. The last person I just want. And it's the same thing that the last people have expected. Every last person I've expected saying the same thing. Or is in a world like this, or every human is watching, even though this guy goes into. It's almost like to convince him. I think in my take, one of these guys trying to convince himself that Nigeria is the best.
Could you pause for a minute? There's something, actually, there's a problem with your voice output. I don't know. You know, it's been happening for some time, but I don't know if it's possible to play back what you're saying, because
I think it's probably the input is fine. I'm looking at it. Okay. The input is fine. You can't hear me well, but
there's a kind of small drag in your voice as you speak.
So, yeah. The input is fine, though. Okay. It's just, okay.
Maybe it's possible with my
unless you want me to stop it and take off the echo noise reduction, then
maybe the latency improves, but
okay. Just you know, because it was happening for some time, but I kept and it kept going on and on. So,
a lot of the last people I expect to want to leave Nigeria, so many of them over the years, last people that have been trickling out in the last 7-8 years, little by little, to now is the point where I was telling somebody like, even the friend of mine she's out here now for the summer. I know she has other troubles out there, but it's not even about the trouble. She just wants to leave, and it's like, wow. So what changes? What gives? Even though she moved when all the all her siblings still live over here, mom still lives here, her dad lives there, and all that. She's just like, there's just so much different.
I think what you just said goes to the point that I made earlier, which is that the Biafran agitation is fueled by this perception, which is based on reality, by the way, of a kind of a particular agenda to impoverish the southeastern part of the country. And this agenda seems to have been there since the end of the war. And I've written and talked about the paradox that a country would squander 2 million lives to uphold the idea of one Nigeria. And then, having attained that, turn around and say to the area that wanted to succeed, which was then forcibly reincorporated into the country, that we are still going to proceed to treat you in so many different ways as if you were second or third class citizens. So there is that reality that is out there. But then, and this is not original to me, in fact, some people have argued, including well-meaning Yoruba and Northern elements, that to the extent that you have an agenda to suppress or oppress a vital part of Nigeria, i.e. the Southeast, that all of Nigeria, the totality of the space of Nigeria, is going to lag behind its potential. So some of the policies, and this is a point that you have made again and again in some of our past podcast episodes, is that when the country sets out with a policy to undercut or undermine or to destroy traders and businessmen from the southeastern part of the country, ultimately the effect on the Nigerian economy, the totality of the Nigerian economy, is magnified, and so that everybody suffers. And that's a way of saying that when you treat every part of Nigeria fairly, every part of Nigeria becomes happier, there'll be peace, there'll be greater prosperity, there'll be a patriotic identification with the Nigerian space. If you treat some parts of the country as, the underclass, then really there's not going to be peace. There's not going to be progress. The country is not going to meet its potential. So what you're saying, I think the point that you just made bears this out, that ultimately we have a country where even those who are supposed to be doing well want out of the country. And so this is the best case for the immediate release of Nnamdi Kanu. Nnamdi Kanu's crime is that he called for the excision of a part of Nigeria to found, you know, the state of Biafra. Nigeria doesn't work for most Nigerians.
Mm-hmm.
It simply doesn't. I was speaking this evening with a businessman who has a very, an important employer of labor in the private sector in Nigeria. But he told me he's been in the U.S. with his family for 6 months. He's not gone back to Nigeria. And he said every time he thinks to go back, he says, what am I going back for? He's told me he's going to lay off some of his workers at the end of this month because he has done contracts not only with the government but with the private sector and is not being paid. And he's done everything. It hasn't been paid. Again, I was speaking a few days ago with the assistant to a major executive in the power sector in Nigeria. And he told me that at every point in their dealings with bureaucrats in the federal government, that anybody who has to sign a form for you now demands nothing less than $100,000 to sign a form. And they're the ones who must sign the form, and that they would not accept $99,900. It's got to be $100,000 or more. And you can't report these people because the people you are going to report them to are also on the take. So this is the way in which systematically the Nigerian state has undermined itself, has sabotaged itself. And so, as Chinua Achebe sort of inimitably said, that Nigeria has become a state that has achieved the feat of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. You know, Nigeria has everything that it has, everything that it takes to become successful. Okay, but at every critical juncture, we take the wrong step, whether in the choice of the leaders we choose. So we're saddled at the moment with a pretend president who clearly stole the election, whose name is in question, whose academic credentials are in question, whose state of origin is in question, whose age is in question, whose criminal history is in question, okay? You can't get more absurd than this as a nation. And so it's important that, on the one hand, we put pressure on the Nigerian government for what it is, illegitimate as it is, criminal in its orientation as it is, that we nevertheless pressure it to do the basic diligence, to do what is right on some basic level. And what is right here is to release Nnamdi Kanu. It is too costly to the lives, to the fortunes, to the future of young men and women in part of Nigeria, that Nnamdi Kanu continues to be in detention, and that on account of his detention, people's lives are now rendered hellish by groups that are often infiltrated by just criminals. Okay? Nigeria cannot continue to be indifferent, to be blind to to the violation of people's civic and civil rights. The right to earn a living, okay? The right to go to school, the right to go to your employment, the right to seek medical treatment, the right to travel within the Nigerian space. These should be rights that at minimum, even an incompetent state should be able to guarantee. But the Nigerian state, in its pretensions to being legitimate, has since lost the capacity to protect these rights. But I think that part of the problem, ultimately, is that, as some people recognize, that the abdication of leadership by the best in Nigeria, the best you have in every part of Nigeria, has led to a situation where somebody like Simon Ekpa, who lives way outside of Nigeria, is able to impose his half-baked, ill-thought, disastrous ideas on his own people. So in the name of helping his people, in the name of liberating his people, he's actually achieving their most brutal destruction and imprisonment. And I think that more and more Igbo politicians, intellectuals, professionals should be part of the conversation and should spread the word amongst our people that this is not the way to go, that this is the path not to liberation, not to freedom, not to the actualization of Biafra, but indeed the path to Armageddon.
Yeah. Well, that's the reality. That's the reality. Hopefully, hopefully it comes to pass sooner than later. But passed away is what I don't know. So we'll see. Nigeria is, it's very interesting that the people, somebody mentioned it today. I was listening to the Nigerian, was it Nigerian TV? I believe so. And I was like, they reminded everybody that the people that are in power now, and he did forget one part, but the people that are in power now were the ones, advocating for restructuring morning, afternoon, and night. Mm-hmm. But he did forget that the person that just left power for 8 years mm-hmm. was also kind of doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. Was doing the same thing. And he was brought into power by the person that has captured, seized power for now. So I don't know where it ends up. It's just very interesting to see how not just the middle class decimated, it's just people don't understand that even when you live overseas, you're feeling the heat. I was telling somebody that yesterday, you're feeling the heat unless two things happen. You structured your life in such a way that you don't interact with people in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Either because you never did or because you've cut them off. Maybe you moved to and you started a family. Most likely you started, you married a level of maybe some middle class, upper middle class white lady, and all these things don't fly. So you've cut that. So you don't pick up their calls. You don't do anything. But generally the way it works is everybody's bugged every day. By requests every day, every time. It doesn't matter whether I give or don't give. They're bugged every day by requests from, and people have no idea when they call you. They think it's maybe one or two people. Even when it's your parents, they think maybe it's but it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Even the ones that call me, I have a friend who's she's not married. But she's literally fine for me. She's more or less financially responsible for the parents. Parents just called her yesterday that they're coming around. I'm just laughing because I've had to drop them off at the airport, and they missed their flight to their own doing. Yeah. I understand their flight. They just looked at her, and she just had to bring out her
credit card and
buy a ticket at the airport. So when she said that they were coming, I didn't bother asking. I'm like, well, if it's not that, I'll take her to these, and they're saying that
she just
bought out the car. Yeah. Like, you think maybe she was saving quite a bit, maybe. She probably has a 401k. I don't know if she dips into that. But the point is, she incurred a great deal of expense. That even as a single person and all that, you know, it's the mentality. Her siblings, she's incurred this expense of moving them to Canada. One sister that is not married, the other sister that is married. And she's still financially responsible for them in Canada, still. She still pays, she's still financially responsible for the one in Canada, paying her bills. She's not married. She funded her relocation to Canada. She gets to Canada, but she's still paying for
her expenses.
Her still expenses in Canada, paying for the parents, paying for. So, you know, even when you do, you can take the distance, but the mentality is
So there's one sort of for me last point that I want to touch. Because just yesterday, the Chief of Army Staff, Major General Labwaja, said that he had ordered troops to go after all the hideouts and all the locations and seize them where the militants of the indigenous peoples of Biafra are hiding. So some people are going to see this as a good development, but I'm troubled. I'm troubled whenever soldiers in Nigeria are sent on an internal mission. As if you consider the history of such missions, it's always it ends in excessive use of force. It ends in massive collateral damage, the death of innocents, the capture and the torture, and sometimes the killing of people whose involvement in militancy is not by any means established. So as much as possible, I think that the Nigerian state should also seek peaceful means. And one of the most peaceful things that the Nigerian state can do now is to release Nnamdi Kanu. If you release Nnamdi Kanu, trust me, the people in the Southeast are capable of then standing up to any criminal who says to them, sit at home. Okay? So these people who are doing the sit at home order sort of find this loophole that Nnamdi Kanu is still being held. And so they sort of deceive the gullible that there is an effect, that there is some way in which you're going to use the sit-at-home order to maybe achieve hasten the release of Nnamdi Kanu from detention. That's not going to work, okay? But then the unleashing of the military on targets, the military doesn't have a good record in Nigeria, a good record of engaging with caution, engaging strategically and tactically in a way that would minimize or eliminate casualties amongst innocent people, okay? In the past, the military would attack an area and just any young man that they see becomes IPOB. You know, basically anybody that they accuse of being IPOB becomes IPOB. And we know that the Nigerian state engages in extrajudicial executions. And so it's not something that I find, it's not something that I'm happy about at all. So perhaps this is an opportunity also for the governors in the Southeast, for organizations in the Southeast, whether it's Ikenga or Ohanaeze, and other community organizations, town-wide organizations, should begin to talk to their young men and indeed to expose their young men that they know to be engaged in this act of criminality, of destroying the livelihoods and the future of the Southeast. So I don't know if you have any closing thoughts before we wave goodbye to our listeners.
It's an ongoing issue, so it's something that we'll keep seeing. We'll see what's going to happen. So we'll see moving forward at all.
That's right. All right. We thank you very much for joining us on this episode, and we're going to come back to you in a matter of days with another episode of the Offside Musings podcast. We cherish you. We really, really are grateful that you join us. Please subscribe to the podcast and subscribe to the Substack column that occasionally accompanies the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right.